Welcome back, Decoders. It's me, your favorite host, Justin Dingman, and this is Science Decoded, a podcast by SciWorthy.com, where we take contemporary, recent research and discoveries and talk to the experts behind these to figure out how they happened, if they're real, and why they matter. Right now, we have a few articles up on SciWorthy.com, many of which written by our young scientists in our YSP program. One of note is the use of ivermectin in COVID-19 treatment. And if you want to learn a little bit more about what ivermectin is and how it's helpful against COVID-19, go ahead and log on to SciWorthy.com and explore our articles. Today on Tips and Tricks, we're going to be talking about what to do when you don't understand a word, phrase, technique, or even an entire section of a science article. Science can have its own language, its own jargon, science-anese, if you will. And it can be really difficult to understand that if you don't have an education or haven't gone through the proper training to talk the talk and to walk the walk. However, thankfully, there's a lot of resources out there to help translate what we do in science and how we talk in science into modern day language. Through the use of websites like Wikipedia, Google, Bing, and Yahoo, you can actually look up any word, any definition, or any technique that you want to know about and educate yourself on that. And when you come across words, phrases, and techniques that you don't understand, I highly recommend looking them up online. There is a plethora of information out there, already put there by other scientists who are already trying to communicate this sort of stuff. You can figure out how hard, how complex, how simple, and how easy how certain techniques and certain methods are to conduct in science. Through a quick Google search, you can also readily understand how theoretical or how practical some of the words and theories that these scientists are using might be for their research. Sometimes when searching for things that you don't understand in a science paper, you come across things that you've never heard of, and sometimes things that not even Google can tell you. This is when reading other science papers can be extremely helpful. Now, it's easy to get caught in a rabbit hole, right? You just want to read one science paper, but before you know it, you have to read science paper D to understand science paper C to understand science paper B before you even understand the one you wanted to in the first place. However, just by simply reading the abstracts of some of these papers, you can get an idea of the concept that is trying to be communicated through science. When you try and write it down yourself, when you try and synthesize it or summarize it in your own words, you can begin to understand more about what the science is talking about. This shows that you've developed an understanding or you've developed a knowledge base of this idea. At first, maybe highlight the top three things that you're most curious about in a certain paper, or maybe that you know the least about. And from there, begin your online search in order to become a more well-rounded and robust learner. Today on Science Decoded, we're going to be talking with Dr. Jonathan Nassy, a scientist at Inscopics Incorporated, about his recent paper published in Cell Reports titled Head-Mounted Microendoscopic Calcium Imaging in Dorsal Premotor Cortex of Behaving Rhesus Macaque. Now, all this title really means is that they used a fancy head-mounted microscope to image the dorsal premotor cortex, an area of the brain, of a rhesus macaque, which is a type of monkey, while it underwent certain behavioral tasks. When looking at the human brain, it's a pretty average appearing organ. It doesn't have muscles, so it doesn't really move around. And even when viewing the brain while someone is conscious, we can't really see much. We have very few ways to image and measure the activity of the human brain. We can do it on a large level, and we can do it on a small level. One popular method is to measure amount of the flow of blood in different parts of the brain as a rough estimate of brain activity. Other strategies use instruments to measure changes in electrical activity that occur during various behaviors, such as sleeping, eating, moving, and thinking. These are typically called EEGs. The use of electrical signals as the brain's way of communicating was first hypothesized in the early 18th century, but it wasn't until 1865 when scientists discovered the action potential, an electrical signal that allows two brain cells, called neurons, to talk to one another. The electrical signals found in the human brain and elsewhere in the body are due to the movement of ions, or electrically charged atoms, through a cell's membrane that can cause the cell to either become activated and fire, or become inhibited and less likely to fire. Remember, electricity is actually just the movement of a charge through space, either positive or negative. Some of the ions used by the brain include potassium, sodium, and calcium, tiny little positively charged metals. So how can we use this information about how brain cells communicate to create better methods to measure brain activity? A major advance happened in 2001 in biochemistry when researcher Junichi Nakai created a hybrid protein called GCAMP. GCAMP is a green fluorescent protein that detects and binds to calcium. Since we know that when a cell becomes activated, calcium rushes into the cell, we can use GCAMP to show this activity when calcium is detected. The GCAMP causes the cell to glow bright green. Since the invention of that protein, various tools using viruses have also been designed so that it could be used in real living cells in order to measure calcium levels. And this technique has since been proven to work in numerous cell models, including mammals. This research, along with advancements in surgery, optics, which is also the physics of light, and instrumentation and engineering, inspired very smart neuroscientists who attempted to answer a very ambitious question. Can we record hundreds or thousands of neurons across days, if not many months? I'm sure many of you have seen those fancy digital simulations of nervous systems on TV and other science videos, where the signal kind of looks like a current, where the signal is represented by a white light cascading randomly, methodically hopping from one nerve to the next. It was images of these very events that the scientists were trying to get. Answering this question got a jumpstart when scientists at Stanford invented a powerful yet small head-mounted fluorescent microscope that uses cameras from iPhones to record these green fluorescent neural events. Since its invention in 2011, this new technique for recording brain activity has been used in hundreds of scientific papers exploring brain function. Dr. Jonathan Nassy, a neuroscientist working with the neurotech company Inscopix, has been developing ways to transition this experimental method from mice into primates. Primates include animals such as monkeys and humans. However, any primate that isn't a human being is called a non-human primate. Shocker. Their groundbreaking work has brought us closer to understanding how the human brain works in both healthy and disease states, and in the hopes of developing better therapies for mental illness and autism. His recent work has demonstrated some impressive and exciting results when using this new miniscope technology and recording activity in primate brains. And after the break, we'll get to talk with Jojo about his most recent paper and the kind of impact his research might make, both scientifically and clinically. So stay tuned. Welcome back, Science Decoders. It's your favorite host, Justin Dingman, and today we're joined by Dr. Jonathan Nassy. Jojo, thanks for joining us today.
Absolutely, my pleasure.
Why don't you introduce yourself and tell us a little bit about your work and your job and your title and where you primarily work?
I'm currently the Senior Director of Translational Science at Inscopix, which is a California-based neurotechnology company that creates brain mapping tools like the miniature microscope that you just described. My role at the company is to oversee our scientific programs, meaning to really think about the strategy and projects we want to pursue and to supervise Inscopix's research and development activities, particularly those meant to have translational or human impact, to make sure that we're conducting studies correctly, interpreting results accurately, and then effectively communicating that both internally to the rest of the company and externally to the wider public. And I think our recent work published in Cell Reports that you mentioned is a great example of this, where we explored whether our miniscope technology could record brain cells or neurons in behaving non-human primates. And so here I was responsible for directing all aspects of the study and help design and execute the experiments, analyze the data, interpret the results, and then package that all up into publication in a peer-reviewed journal article to communicate the results to the scientific community.
How long have you been practicing in your field so far?
Yeah, it's a great question. So let's see. Gosh, I got to go back. So I got my PhD back in 2007. So what? That's about 14 years or so. I did, you know, my PhD then. I did a couple postdoctoral fellowships at Harvard Medical School and at the Salk Institute in San Diego. And then I've been with Inscopix for the last 6 years.
Wow, that's quite a bit of time. But it just means that you've done a lot of reading, a lot of work, a lot of writing as well.
Right.
So
right.
more specifically talking about this paper you published in Cell Reports. How would you describe this fancy mini microscope that's used in the experiment and what makes it work so well for this type of imaging?
The best way to describe the miniature microscope itself is to compare it to the microscopes that most of the audience might be familiar with, which is the benchtop fluorescent microscope. Most of us at some point have used a benchtop microscope in a science class to examine a sample on a slide, for example, seawater or some kind of tissue. And here you're shining fluorescent light down through the microscope onto whatever sample you're trying to magnify or see. And the light that basically reflects off of that and comes back into the microscope is what a microscope like that collects, allowing you to image the sample. Now, those kinds of microscopes are large and bulky, sitting on your benchtop, and can be used to image not only tissue samples, but also live animals. However, the big problem with this when trying to image, for instance, the brain in live animals is that you would have to have the animal immobilized or somehow fixed underneath this big stationary microscope, which significantly constrains the types of behaviors and underlying brain functions that one can study. And so the miniscope is a significant scientific advance for live animal imaging because we've basically miniaturized that benchtop microscope down to the size of your fingertip, making it very small and very light, weighing less than 2 grams. The key advantage of that is now the animal can essentially wear this microscope on its head and can move around and freely behave while we monitor and record their brain activity. And if we really want to understand how the brain works in both healthy and diseased states, this is really a key capability. We need to be able to record neuronal activity when animals engage in natural free behaviors.
This microscope, it's not just something you wear on top of your head though, right? It does require some kind of surgery and is physically attached to the skull, correct?
The microscope itself does come on and off the animal, really kind of plug and play, docking and undocking. But you're right, there is a chronic implant with the animal. You know, there's a series of steps that basically are involved in preparing the animal for imaging studies. And I think we'll get into some of those, you know, ranging from delivering the fluorescent calcium sensors to the brain and implanting basically a small glass micro lens into the brain, which basically relays a high resolution image from deep into the brain up to above the skull, where you then have this miniature microscope docked and can conduct then your imaging.
So just like in every scientific paper or article published, there's always a hypothesis behind why we do what we do. What was your hypothesis, or what was the gap you're attempting to fill in with your knowledge in science?
I think it's a great question. I think in all endeavors in science, but particularly here, as we think about the brain, there are many different levels in which we can explore and examine something. For the brain, you can study it at the microscale or subcellular level, looking at how molecules or chemical signals are moving around inside the cells and how they act and change over time. You can also study the brain at the macro scale or whole brain level. For instance, there are techniques out there like certain brain scans that provide a very zoomed out view and can give us a good sense of the overall picture of what the brain is doing. However, there's been a gap in the field for a very long time, and that has been our very limited ability to study the brain at the in-between level, or what we sometimes call the mesoscale or circuit level. So at the mesoscale, you're not looking within individual cells or at the whole brain, but a collections of hundreds to thousands of interconnected cells, which we often refer to as brain circuits, to understand how they connect, communicate, and drive behavior and cognition. And what we're trying to do is to fill in that gap, and this miniature microscope and the calcium imaging that it enables really allows you to characterize the mesoscale effectively in several different ways. And one I've already covered, which it allows you to image brain activity while an animal is freely behaving. Two is that by relying on these genetically encoded calcium sensors to provide the signals for imaging, we're actually able to target very specific kinds and types of cells. For example, cells that contain a specific chemical signal like dopamine or serotonin, or cells that connect to specific but different brain regions. And this is a huge advance over traditional recording technologies that are typically blind to cell type. And finally, by coupling the miniature microscope with those glass microlenses that I mentioned previously that can be implanted into the brain, we can image large numbers of neurons in deep regions, essentially granting us access to every part of the brain. And so all of these things together really enable an extremely powerful way to fill in this gap of understanding the brain at the mesoscale or circuit level. And this is important because there's now a lot of evidence that suggests that this level is really key to understanding not only our everyday behavior, but also brain disorders that occur in many different patient populations. This was really our, you know, describing our basically our first attempt and successful demonstration of being able to apply this miniscope technology and calcium imaging in non-human primate models.
So you had mentioned also using genetically encoded calcium molecules through what's called a viral vector strategy in order to visualize these neurons or these brain cells. Can you describe a little bit about what the viral vector strategy was and how you were able to actually make cells flash that you could change into these images when monitoring calcium concentration?
Yeah, absolutely. In our publication, we used, as you just referred to, a genetically encoded calcium sensor. And the genetically encoded part is super important here because there are calcium sensors that have been around for a while that are essentially organic dyes that can be put into the brain and get incorporated into cells more or less at random, but they don't allow you to be targeted to specific cells. So the genetically encoded part means that you can actually deliver your calcium sensor to very specific types of cells via DNA or RNA. And so to do this, we use viral vectors or viruses. The most commonly used one is the adeno-associated virus, or AAV. And you may be familiar with AAVs because AAVs are used today for gene therapy in humans for all sorts of different applications. And so we're using that same AAV system to deliver the calcium sensor, which is essentially a fluorescent molecule that detects calcium when it enters a cell, when the cell becomes activated. And the cool part is that when the calcium is detected, the sensor causes the cell to increase its fluorescence, or basically light up, which we can record with our microscope as a proxy of neuronal activity when animals are performing a specific task or responding to specific stimuli.
So some of the new or novel science that's come out of this paper is the use of this genetically targeted calcium sensor, as well as this mini microscope that you guys use. But it's also important that this science has been transitioned into primates. And since it's been transitioned into primates, what do we actually stand to learn from this kind of science?
Right. I think there are a couple of important points to make here. So the first is that, similar to how we talked about different levels of analysis of the brain and how we're filling in the gap in that way, it's also important to study the brain across many different animal model species. And the reason for doing that is that all species are, of course, alike in some ways and different in other ways. And this is true from mice all the way up to humans. As we investigate these different animal models and compare across multiple species, it's much easier to then understand which discoveries are most likely to translate to humans. For example, if we find something that happens in a mouse brain but can't replicate it in a rat or a primate brain, then we would be much less certain that it occurs in humans. So this cross-species investigation and validation is really important, and primates are really at the more advanced end of that spectrum. And then the second point to make here is that non-human primates, and in particular, the rhesus macaque, which has been one of the gold standard animal models in neuroscience for many decades, they're highly similar to humans. And of course, they're not the same, but in terms of a single species that we can study, the rhesus macaque has high similarity to humans, not only in terms of brain structure and function, but also in terms of their complex cognitive and behavioral abilities, which are more similar to humans than that exhibited by worms, fruit flies, or rodents. And so the findings in primate are more likely to translate to humans, and that's why it's important to apply these new techniques and technologies in this important model species.
Are there limitations you see in transitioning this kind of technology and research from primates into humans?
Yeah, I mean, I'd say that, you know, those limitations are kind of, or barriers are slowly coming down, I would say. I mean, I think it's important to say that that's, you know, certainly not the primary focus for us, is sort of to literally bring this technology and miniature microscope technology into humans, at least not, as I said, today. But it is interesting to think about the fact that more and more we're seeing, you know, as we talked about a second ago, you know, gene therapies like AAV gene therapies that are being used in the brain, right? And so similar to those same AAVs, as I mentioned, are being used to basically deliver these genetically encoded calcium sensors. And then, of course, these microlenses that get implanted into the brain in these animal studies, you know, we have a lot of advances now happening in terms of deep brain electrodes that are used for Parkinson's patients in humans, and all sorts of other sort of neuroprosthetics. So the concept, at least, of, you know, using a virus to deliver calcium sensors and devices to implant it to the brain, those are actually more and more, you're starting to see those aspects becoming a reality, you know, in human clinical populations. But our focus is really very much, you know, on both supporting sort of fundamental basic neuroscience, and also informing sort of our understanding of disease and informing therapeutic development, but really focused on applying these techniques and technologies in animal models.
And as you stated, because of the close relationship between the rhesus macaque and humans, Homo sapiens, we actually can begin to draw conclusions and kind of understand how this science works on a more complex level with a more neuroscientifically complex animal, such as a monkey that's able to display complex behavior and cognition.
That's right. Exactly. Yeah. And it's, you know, a lot of these technologies, you know, they're often developed in lower order species and rodents or what have you. And honestly, it takes quite a while and a lot of work to move them up into non-human primates. And it really takes a focused effort, often by, you know, many folks in the field to really make that happen. But I think that, you know, it really is critical if we really want to understand the brain and be able to make that connection to the actual human condition, as you just mentioned.
So typically in science, our results or our the data and information that we actually use and read and interpret, they come in different forms than what we typically present on graphs or in figures or in tables. This is oftentimes known as raw data. You know, what was the raw data like from your experiments, and how did you go about converting that raw data into images and videos?
Yeah, right. So the raw data in our case are these videos of imaged activity in the brain. And because we have cells lighting up and dimming down, we're literally watching them turn on and off, which is actually really fun to watch. And these videos are basically a symphony of lights across a field of view that we now have to make sense of and extract results from. Our main goal is to extract changes in fluorescence in identified individual neurons across time for each of these videos that we can then line up to actions or events that happen to the animal during the experiment to see if the neurons are responding in some way to those behaviors or stimuli. And so to get us there, the videos go through a series of steps to allow us to isolate the relevant signals. We start with some basic image processing steps to clean up the video, such as adjusting the contrast and stabilizing the video in case there are some motion artifacts we need to correct for. And then we use various statistical algorithms to first identify where the neurons are in the video, and then second, to pull out and extract the dynamic calcium traces from each of those neurons. And once we have that, we can then line up those calcium traces of the hundreds of imaged neurons to see how these different activity patterns may correlate or relate to specific actions of the animal or events the animal is experiencing. For example, are these neurons turning on or off when the animal is socially interacting with another animal or moving its body in specific ways? And so that's essentially how we go from those really, you know, beautiful, exciting videos of cells turning on and off, flashing before your eyes, to the actual results that we can then, you know, further interpret and understand what's happening.
And as the designer of this kind of project or these experiments, what are some of the key methodological advances that you guys made during this research?
Fundamentally, this is a methods paper. So the aim was to describe really for the first time that you can use this miniscope technology for calcium imaging in behaving macaques. And because this is really a first proof of concept, there were honestly a lot of questions going in, because while we've applied this tech to rodents extensively over the past 10 years, it was really an unknown whether the approach would also translate to macaques. And that's everything from, can we express the genetically encoded calcium sensors with this AAV technology, you know, as readily as we've been able to in rodents? What are the proper surgical techniques and protocols to implant these micro lenses? And what's the nature and quality of the signal that we're actually going to be able to get out of the macaque brain? And, you know, the exciting takeaway is that it, you know, it absolutely does translate. And I would say we were pretty surprised by how readily it actually translated. Certainly the years of development in rodents, I think, you know, was a big advantage for us. And possibly also just, you know, certainly the group of scientists and our collaborators that worked on this, I think we came in with a lot of experience bringing different types of technologies in the past kind of for the first time into primates. And so not only can we do this now in the macaque with the surgical techniques and protocols that we established, but we can use these viral strategies that I mentioned previously to record from specific cell types during behavior and do so longitudinally and stably over long periods. And in this case, over 8 months. And that's really important for these types of studies in macaque, where you're typically training the animals extensively, spending many months, you know, really just training the animal on behavioral tasks. So you really want to be able to record an image from these animals for as long as possible.
So talking about the behavior of these macaques, then the behavioral task involves the primate actually reaching out its hand to get a treat and then eating that treat as a reward. What did you learn about the primate's brain through this behavior? And what did the images and videos reveal about this primate behavior?
Yeah, so as I just mentioned, this paper was primarily a proof of concept or methods advancement to see if we could apply the miniscope technology for use in non-human primates. And so we wanted to validate the approach with something that we already know to be true, but also show the potential capabilities of where this can be taken in the future. So here, from a methods validation standpoint, we imaged from neurons in the premotor cortex, where we know that these neurons should encode intentional motor behavior, or in this case, the direction that the animal reaches, which is also why we chose this particular behavioral task. What this means is that we expect that individual neurons will increase or decrease their activity depending on the specific location to which the animal reaches. And this is exactly what we found in our study. And if you look across all the neurons as a population, they're thought to encode the entire space in which the animal might reach to. And this is cool because what we can then do is take the activity of the entire population of cells and decode or predict where the animal is actually reaching on a given trial, which we were able to do in this paper. And so while not a discovery per se, these results were very exciting because it allowed us to validate the method and compare it to what's been shown previously with other approaches. One exciting new thing that we showed is that we can actually track these neurons over long periods, something that's not easy to do with other technologies. And so this is just one example of the promise of this new approach, as we can begin to ask questions like, how stable are these responses over time? What kinds of changes do we see as the animal learns a new behavior? And what kinds of changes do we see associated with the onset and progression of neurodegenerative or neuropsychiatric disease?
You know, just out of curiosity, honestly, for myself, what did you notice much of a delay or an ability to predict an animal's behavior based on the calcium signaling of the neurons in the brain before the animal actually had a visible action?
Yeah, that's a great question. So, you know, there's actually, when you do sort of these sorts of decoding analyses, there's, you know, kind of two main approaches to it. One is sort of online decoding and one is offline decoding. And so in online decoding, you're literally, as you're recording live, you're taking the signals you're recording, you're running them through some algorithms, and you're predicting literally during that trial that the animal's reaching, before the animal reaches, you know, which direction they're going to reach to. And so in an online decoding, you know, you can really get at that question that you were just asking, right? Which is like, you know, what's the kind of timing of this and the delay, or how much time before the actual reach do you need to measure that activity? In this case, as a first step, we didn't have a setup for online decoding. And so all of the analysis was done offline. And so we're basically, you know, taking all of the measured recordings from those experiments. And again, still looking at a trial by trial level to see if we can basically take the activity that we measured and, you know, quote unquote, predict the animal's reach, right? But then we're basically looking to see how accurate that prediction was all offline after the experiment. So I think it's a great question. And I think certainly as we think about, you know, using decoding like this in more applied ways, I think, you know, it's going to be interesting to investigate sort of the timing of these signals and their predictive ability in more detail.
Absolutely. And, you know, we're always told about reaction time and how many seconds that is or how many seconds that takes. But it's really interesting to me to potentially use this technology to see the actual difference between cognition and result, and understand how also maybe more complex cognition may take longer time to work itself through before you see a result from that.
Yeah, absolutely. And there's a lot of research that's been done looking at sort of like prior to the animal making its movement or making a decision, kind of the changes in activity that you can observe in the brain, and some really great work sort of, you know, sort of presenting sort of distracting stimuli, for instance, to sort of disrupt that decision making or delay that response time. So that's a very active area of research. And I think, you know, this technology can definitely be used to investigate that further, especially in terms of asking questions about which types of neurons are involved. And over time, does the brain region or the cell populations sort of change their coding and their ability to support those kinds of behaviors?
So all in all, given the time from you started thinking and planning about this study to the point of publication, how much time did it take you guys to get all the steps and go through everything and make sure everything checked out to get to the point now where you have this finished proof of methods paper?
Great question. Let me think here. You know, there's probably about, it definitely takes, you know, longer than I would say rodent studies, just like even literally to just sort of develop, set up and plan and get everything in place, certainly. But yeah, I would say that, you know, the studies themselves were basically all done over the course of about a year and a half or so. And there's probably a good 6 months at least of pretty like detailed focused planning and sort of developing all the, you know, implant hardware and different sort of surgical protocols that we plan to undertake. And then, you know, a great part of your question is then, of course, even after you've collected all that data, you know, analyzed it, which, you know, probably took another 3 to 4 months or so, then how long does it take to actually get it published, right? And so, I mean, one interesting thing is just the open source or kind of preprint databases now, like BioArchive. So it was actually up there pretty soon after we finished the analysis and wrote something up. But probably all in all, from beginning to end, getting it actually out there and published in Cell Reports, you know, I want to say it was probably a good three and a half years of work to get it to this point.
Yeah, and I think it just goes to show, too, a lot of people think that science and technology, especially discoveries like this, you know, all of a sudden one day it works in a lab and you call a newspaper and everybody knows about it.
But right.
I think it's a little bit different nowadays with the rigorous nature of publishing science articles and how much detail has to go into making sure that everything is very robust, defensible, and provable, and also repeatable in what you're trying to attempt.
Absolutely, yeah. As a scientist and an author, as you're going through that review process, you know, it could be pretty grueling at times, but I've never come out at the end and not felt like the paper is, you know, much improved, and that the scientific rigor is, you know, just much better. And so I think the peer review process is absolutely critical to all of this. And definitely this paper, you know, was significantly advanced and improved through that process.
Now, we've touched a little bit upon technological applications for this technology, but what are your hopes for it moving forward? And can this be used for anything therapeutic?
Yeah, this is a great question and one that's very important to us at Inscopix. I think there are a couple of different ways, you know, we see that how the tech can be used. The first way is, of course, for fundamental neuroscience research, really filling the gap in our understanding of the brain at the mesoscale or circuit level. And we've already seen so many exciting breakthrough discoveries published based on studies in rodents, and it will be really exciting to see the same in the near future for studies in non-human primates, really advancing our understanding of how the brain works in a model species relevant to humans. The second way we see the technology having a big impact is toward informing therapeutic development for brain disorders. The debilitating symptoms associated with most brain disorders, be it Parkinson's, schizophrenia, or autism, are now thought to be largely driven by dysfunctional activity at the circuit level. And so understanding both what normal circuit level functioning looks like and then how it goes awry in disease will really lay the foundation for the development of next generation therapeutics that are hopefully much more precise and effective than what currently exists today. And this is the case for small molecule drug development, gene therapies, as well as devices like deep brain stimulation and brain-computer interfaces, which we believe can be significantly advanced and optimized based on circuit-level readouts from the brain. And so overall, I think there are many different avenues through which this technology can and already is making a translational impact. And then in the long run, we hope this will ultimately help to improve outcomes for people suffering from diseases affecting the brain. And at the end of the day, our goal is really to create powerful new neuroscience tools and technologies to improve brain health. And we're really just really excited about the breakthroughs, discoveries, and better treatments that lie ahead.
Absolutely. And I think I can say also on behalf of everyone at SciWorthy how impressed that we've been with the images and the results and the videos that have come out of this study and from these papers and the application that it has and the possibilities that it has to show us more about how the brain functions and what's important in brain functioning. But before I let you go, Jojo, I always ask one question at the end of every podcast. Why'd you come on the podcast today? And what do you hope to say to anyone who might be listening out there that is curious about your job or your science and just about exploration in general?
Yeah, well, I think first and foremost, you know, thank you very much for the opportunity to come on the podcast. I think that it's always really exciting and a pleasure to be able to, you know, share all, like we were talking about, all the hard work, the 3.5 years of effort, right, that we weren't doing for no good reason, right? This was very important to us. We think it's going to have a big impact on the field and for human health. And so it's just so important to communicate that to the rest of the public. And I think coming on your podcast is just such a great way to do that. And really the opportunity to you know, not everyone's going to pick up a Cell Reports article out there. And so it's so important to communicate this to the wider public and really to get their support ultimately for this kind of work, because it's super important and it can't just be supported by the scientific community. It has to be supported by, you know, a much wider community. You know, that's really the primary reason. And again, really just appreciate and thank you for the opportunity.
Absolutely. Well, Jojo, thanks for your time. We know you're a busy doctor out there conducting all different types of primate and rodent research. So we really appreciate any time a big time scientist can take the time out of their day to talk to us and explain a little bit about what they did so that everybody can understand it. So thank you for your time.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks, Justin. Really appreciate it.
Hi, Gina here. Thanks for listening to Science Decoded. We want to thank our host with the most, Justin Dingman, as well as our behind-the-scenes team members, Osama Alien and Garrett Campion. Our channel artwork was designed by Tammy Whitsons, and our theme song was written and recorded by Graham Albright. We'd also like to thank our Patreon and local supporters. Without all of you, we couldn't do what we do. SciWorthy is an initiative of the 501c3 nonprofit Blue Marble Space. You can learn more at www.bluemarblespace.org.